So we've, I think we've set a new record in terms of time passing between podcast episodes.
Yes, between the episodes, certainly. Like, we've still got that gap from when we were born to the first episode. Actually, I don't know when you would measure that from. When's the...
I do remember that the first thing the doctor said to me is, your time starts now.
Yeah. It's been a long time. It's been since November.
I was just going to say, a lot has happened.
Yeah. One of the things that's happened is that you left me for another company.
I have. Mm. Yeah, I don't know how much you want to talk about it. It feels very self-indulgent. But yes, I left the Googles and I went to Shopify.
Yeah, I am really... I'm really interested because we have met up and chatted outside of a
no,
podcast.
Jake,
I
know. We only talk through the podcast.
On that note, so I've been doing the 203 episodes with other people.
Yeah.
I did some episodes with Ada and done some episodes with Cassie as well, Cassie Evans, and people are furious. About the... Well, okay, no. Two weird guys are furious about the Cassie episode because I dared talk to Cassie about things which weren't animation. And they have, like... They said, this is a waste of Cassie's time and my time and everyone's time. How dare this happen? It's really weird. Like...
Yeah, how dare you talk to someone who does web development about things that are related to web development?
I know, it's a kind of weird gatekeeping, isn't it? Like, I'm pretty sure they think they're protecting...
The white knighting, some good white knighting going
it's
on. Deciding that you are wasting Cassie's time, which, as far as I know, is still Cassie's decision?
I think it is, you know. Knowing Cassie, I think she would have told me if she felt like her time was being wasted.
She would have walked out on you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's strange, isn't it? Because, like, you know, where were they when you were telling me about, you know, dithering? That's not my field of expertise. Like,
no.
How dare you waste my time talking about, I can't think of any. Oh, I'm sure you did one on, like, WebGL or something else that wasn't my field of expertise. I did a whole episode about keyboard events with Ada. It just seems to be really weird, like some sort of crossover of things that has happened where it's like, I think you'll find Cassie only talks about animation, so you're only allowed to do this. Anyway.
I think you'll find you have to pigeonhole Cassie, and if you don't do that, you're offensive.
Exactly. I was worried because, you know, me and Cassie went to the pub to discuss the episodes and that kind of thing, and we talked about all sorts, you know. I'm so thankful those guys weren't there because they would have been, like, tearing the place apart, you know, smashing glasses and plates. They'd be, like, bright red in the face. Like, what are you just talking about TV shows? She does animation. She does animation. How?
She always talks about animation only.
I know. Anyway, sorry, we were talking about you. I was literally wasting your time there by talking about things that you're not expert in. So let's talk about Shopify.
it's a company, and I work for them now.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
All right. You said now, and usually when people say now, that's them leading on to saying something else.
Oh no, I work there now.
Oh, I heard like I work there now.
Now here is all the gossip about Shopify. No,
now, let me tell you.
I'm not quite sure what would be of interest. So I joined as an engineer working on anything to do with developer experience, and that is intentionally vague. Shopify has been growing at an absolutely wild rate over the last couple years. You know, they have this percentage thing. How many people at Shopify, how many people have been newer at you than Shopify? And like when I joined, obviously 0% were newer at Shopify than me, but only 2 weeks later, it was like 2.5%, and now it's 16% of people at Shopify are newer than me, and I've been there 4 months now.
Mm. I mean, that could also be like you joined, and then a bunch of people were like, right, well, we're out. you know?
Yes, sure.
And also, that's what happened to the stock price, I seem to remember, right? That you joined and the stock price just like absolutely...
Coincidence? I think not.
One of the things I'm actually really interested to hear about is the interview process, like not just at Shopify, but, you know, general like job hunting, because that's something that I've not done in 9 years. It's something that you hadn't done for quite a long time as well. So
it was actually really interesting. As you said, like we both have talked about interviewing at Google quite a lot, both on the podcast, but also like between us, because, you know, the process at Google has its edges, its job edges that we are not always happy with. And we were always talking about how much liberty can we as individual interviewers take to make the process more meaningful or better without manipulating the system or giving an unfair advantage to anyone. I did interview. I didn't get this job like through the back door or anything, although I did get interest in Shopify because our former director, Dion Almer, is now at Shopify, and I kind of kept in touch with him. And when he talked to me a bit about what his job entailed or what his team works on and what kind of things they need, that's kind of how I got even interested, because e-commerce is not something I know a lot about or used to be very passionate about, to be honest. Like, we had an e-commerce team at Google as well, like a DevRel team even, I guess, or at least people working in the vicinity of that, and it just never really tickled me in the right way. So that's why it actually, like, the company wasn't really on my radar, but then through Dion, effectively, I read up on it and heard from him about how they work and what their goal is. But yeah, basically, I then went through the normal formal interview process at Shopify, and it is sufficiently different from what Google is doing. The first thing that was notably different is they are quick. They move fast. When you say you want to interview, they send you an email. Like, at least for the couple of processes I have observed and experienced, they tell you a day later to choose from these couple of dates where your interviews could happen. So it's like that's a pretty quick turnaround. Similar to Google, it was five interviews, individual interviews with very different focal points. So the first two were like it was like pair programming, basically, but in the end it's a coding interview.
I was going to say I'm not very good at pair programming. Like, that's a real weakness of mine.
I think you're right, because we used to do it in the office quite a lot. It's just you sit with someone, one person is coding, and sometimes the other person throws in, you made a mistake, or challenges why you made a thing a certain way, and then you have to justify it. Or the person who's coding asks a question because I don't know exactly how to continue on this certain path. Like, it's just like one person is coding, but there's two brains involved.
Right.
So it's not like the, you know, NCIS two people using one keyboard moment or anything like that.
I just find, like, in pair programming, like, I ever feel like I'm being dragged along by the other person, or I'm like dragging the other person along, and I never feel like either is helpful. Like, it never feels helpful to me when I'm being dragged along. I find, like, I get much more out of code reviewing than I do pair programming, like, in terms of like me learning a thing.
I think in general, I agree. Like, for me, like, let's start a coding session and work through this issue is not something I do very often. Mostly because I move quite fast and write messy code and clean up later. And many people do not work that way. And so that makes it incredibly incompatible, because I need to slow down to take the other person with me. But that makes me lose my train of thought. And it just goes against my intuition, I suppose. What I do like, and I think it's something that the two of us have done back in the day in the office, is that if someone hits a problem, you pull someone over and you rubber duck them, you explain the problem, and then you tackle the problem together.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, I think, is very helpful.
And what, you know, scribble it on a whiteboard or whatever, or, you know, absolutely. Yeah, that doesn't count as pair programming to me. That's kind of pair problem solving.
I would file that under pair programming. I mean, that's currently how we're doing it. That's actually really interesting, that at Shopify, which The company is entirely remote. So everybody is working from home. They basically let go of most offices at the start of the pandemic and went to what they call a digital by design principle, that everybody is remote and works from home or from wherever they want. And the company accommodates that. And one of the things they have is a program called Tuple, which is, it's like Google Meet, but it's optimized for screen sharing and pair programming, where you can take over the other person's mouse and keyboard or draw on the other person's screen to be like, hey, you made a mistake here. It's really good. I genuinely enjoy it. It gets like the how like Google Meet is really bad at sharing a screen at a high frame rate and it makes things janky. This tool doesn't. I don't know how, but it's like super responsive most of the time.
I have to say, is that that kind of pair problem solving is something that I have never managed to recreate remotely properly. Like I did some spec work in February on the history spec, and we all went, well, three of us went to Boston and sat in a room to do this standards work, and it felt like we got more done that week than we'd got done like the six months a year beforehand, because we had the whiteboard, we had it was easier to for three people to talk at once and manage that without someone having to press the hands up icon on the chat thing.
And I think that will remain true. Like FaceTime is still irreplaceable, and we do like at Shopify, they do try to do what they call bursts, basically offsites, getting in person, getting together once a quarter, now that travel is more and more possible again, to have that. But the whole, this Tuple thing actually makes it sufficiently good that on a regular basis, I jump on with some of the other engineers on the projects I work on, and when they have a problem, they get stuck, or I don't know how to do a thing, you jump on a Tuple call and just help the other person or get help from the other person. And it works really, really well. So that was a really interesting experience to see that, how that is just part of the culture. You're like, hey, you want to Tuple this? Yeah, let's do it. And then you actually do move quite quickly through a problem if the other person has expertise or you have expertise for the other person. That's really cool.
So with the kind of like when you were doing like coding interview style stuff, like because you didn't just interview at Shopify, right? Did you go to other places as well?
Yeah, I had a couple other irons in the fire, but in the end, I think only with Shopify I decided to go through the full process in the end. And so the first coding exercise was, admittedly, really simple. It's basically like it was like, here is a little app, little game you're supposed to build, go, and you can use whatever you want. And it was,
well, I mean, what's the little game? Was it Minesweeper? Because I mean, that took us more than an interview's worth of time.
Well, exactly. You make trade-offs, right? In this case, it was basically you have a grid, and you have a.
It's already sounding like Minesweeper, mate.
Yeah, it is a grid. You have a player in the grid, and you build buttons that can make the player move around the grid, like basically up, down, left, right, and then you add support for collision with walls and then obstacles, and then in the end you automate to find a path. That was the level, and it's really nice. And I was like, you know what, for the sake of moving fast, I'm just gonna inner HTML the shit out of this. I basically just wrote the game engine, if you want to call it that. I didn't use React. I didn't use any of the frameworks, even though I guess with React, I would have scored points because Shopify is a whole React shop as of now. But I just basically updated a div's inner HTML and just assembled a table markup whenever a button was clicked.
And it's one of those cases where an HTML table is the right thing to use, right? Because
I assume so.
I think so. Like it's a two-dimensional. I mean, it's maybe difficult with games, isn't it? Because it's not literally a data table, but it is one of the two-dimensional accessible structures that we have.
Yeah. I did ask if this needs to be accessible, and they said no, which is then fine. I guess if they said yes, I would have had to think a lot harder whether a table was the right decision here or not. But in this case, they apparently didn't care in the context of the interview.
Nice.
So that was an hour-long interview, I think. The second part was, and that I thought was really interesting, and I wonder if that's something that Google could learn from, was a so-called life story, where the recruiter just had an hour-long chat with me and just wanted to hear my life story. And it would just become a dialogue about like my path from where I started to where I am today and what drove me.
So what do you think there, what are they like scoring on there? What's the, is it just like a general, can you communicate?
I think it's what drives you as a person, but also the way you present your work, how well you're able to present your work. So yeah, communication, whether you're a team player, whether you're an egocentric, you know, there's many flags that probably could come up in the way you tell your story. It felt honestly really weird because, again, super self-indulgent, just like, oh, and then I did this and then I did that. And it was, on the one hand, it was really nice actually to like revisit all the things I had done because many things I had kind of forgotten about. And then through the process of telling the story, I kind of remembered. But it felt also a bit egocentric. Yeah, so those were the first two interviews. And then the other three were another coding challenge, which was this time a bit harder. I'm trying to remember what the question was. I don't quite remember. The fourth one was a systems design question. So this was not coding, but more of like, here is a product we want to build or a little addition to a product. How would you design this? And this was actually a bit more of a full stack question, not necessarily, but like, how do you build the backend, but more about like the API design and the requirements for the implementation of that API. Like which of these APIs endpoints need to be real time, which of these things could be just JSON, what would be a WebSocket, how would you consume this, and so on and so forth. That was arguably the interview that went worst for me. Mostly because I haven't done that crap in a long, long time. Like in our job, we have built static sites. Like we specialized for the last couple of years in static sites because they're so performant and haven't really built much with dynamic backends.
Yes, and that is one of the things where I feel, I don't know, a little bit left out in the industry because we build a lot of stuff static. You know, things like Squoosh, procs, it's all static builds. But I find mostly when I want to have a server component, it's because I want to use WebSockets in some way. And that just doesn't sort of exist in that model, as far as I've seen. Like, you know, once you're on, you know, the new generation of, you know, server framework things like your Next.js, that kind of thing, like they're not set up to do WebSocket stuff, and I fall back to either setting up my own cloud instance of a thing, or use glitch.com if it's just a demo thing, because WebSockets don't seem to really fit into any of these like edge driven models.
Well, now there's Dino Deploy.
Dino Deploy, does that do WebSockets though? That's the
I haven't.
Or maybe it does. Because I've not looked at that. Oh, I tell you what. The other thing I tend to need is storage. And Dino, I know Dino's been looking at that. Like, well, essentially using something like IndexedDB or local storage as their storage system. But I don't think it's there yet. Is it?
No. All right. I think for now, that's something we can. Let's do tangents. We like tangents, right?
Oh, we do.
I took on an advisory role at Dino, which was a really serendipitous story. I don't know.
Serendipitous. Let's go with that. How would I know? I said specificity in a video time, and didn't even realize I was saying it wrong because it's specificity.
It is specificity. Any CSS DA at Google needs to say that 10 times fast in the interview.
Absolutely.
I've heard from you.
That's the whole interview. You've got to do it in one.
And if you mess up once, you're gone. You're out.
Yeah, hiring's really hard.
Ryan Dahl reached out to me basically 2 days after I signed with Shopify. And I was like, hey, so we saw your Dino video because we did a Dino video on 203. And apparently they were looking to step up their game around outreach and advocacy. And I was like, oh, that's that's nice. And he kind of was talking about whether I wanted to join the company. And I was like, that actually sounds really interesting. But just signed a contract. Luckily, Shopify allows, like in the contract, it allows side hustles as long as you're not, you know, helping a competitor, which at Google wasn't allowed. You would have to get an exception, which I've never even tried. No. But it was nice to have this as like, yeah, how about we don't do this as like, I don't, you know, join your company, but I would love to like help you as an advisor. And maybe we just have regular syncs meetings with you and the team, and I can listen to what you are thinking about and give in my two cents, which is basically just me having opinions, and I can always have opinions. That sounds fun.
Opinions for money.
Exactly. But I mean, in the end, I spent the last 7 years at Google.
That's my job. I mean, it's a lot of people's job in the web industry is opinions for money, right? Especially the higher up you get. opinion for more money.
We spend a lot of time understanding the web platform and developers and how these two things are moving with each other or against each other, and what developers need and what they should want but don't actually want, and how the ecosystem is evolving. Like, that all was part of DevRel, and that, you know, over 7 years, you do build up a bit of experience. And since Dino is, you know, really doubling down on being the web platform but on the edge, that seems to be a useful skill for them. And so I've been working with them for a couple of months now. And it's been really interesting. They are building something what I think will be really cool, which is like a really interesting edge runtime where you as a web developer come in and you already know it. Like there's not much to learn for you. You can just straight up start building. And I think that's really cool. That it kind of turns a web developer into a full stack developer just by implementing the same APIs with the same semantics.
Well, we talked about it in the last episode, I believe, because I built the, in my intro to the world of cores.
Oh, yes, you did use Dino Deploy for that.
The server side component for that was Dino Deploy, and it was, yeah, it worked pretty well. But yeah, like having storage, that would, if you can do storage and WebSockets, then really that is my other use case done.
I think WebSockets they have currently, I think for database, but you can always do something like, you know, go to the free tier at Planet Scale or Redis or whatever and plug in an external database. That's always possible.
As you said, that would probably do it. Because all the things that I've built like that have been like a tiny little bit of state. But that state needs to be broadcast when it changes. And so that was like big web quiz, right? Like what we used to do in person CDS. That's all that is. WebSockets, tiny little bit of state. That I would like to survive if the server rebooted. I recently built a game which was just a reaction test game, but it had a scoreboard, and so there was a scoreboard screen. And it's again, there it is, tiny little bit of state, WebSocket broadcasting, job done.
What was this game for, Jake?
Oh yeah, that was for Google.io because Chrome now sponsors the McLaren Formula One team. I like Formula One, so I obnoxiously as I could inserted myself into that part of the team.
And you succeeded.
And I succeeded, and that's the main thing that matters. But yeah, we had a Google.io had a McLaren F1 car, and next to it was this reaction test game, which built in, well, our week, really, with the agency doing the design the week before. It was like a two-week turnaround. It was fun because I had all these big ideas when I got into the meeting. I was saying, look, here's all the things I think we can build in partnership with McLaren. Pow, 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 pow. And then they were like, oh, that sounds great. So, you know, how many of those can we have in time for Google.io in 2.5 weeks? I was like, none of those. Let's just sweep all those to one side. But I once built a reaction test game with Formula One lights, so we could just do that. But here's the thing, again. and we did. And we did it, but we did it better.
I mean, when you build it for the first time, even then, it got into the hands of real-world Formula One drivers, didn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it did. It's the only thing I've ever built that went truly viral. And now anything else I ever build will never be as successful as that 1 hour I spent on that reaction game.
It's probably the peak example of the infamous effort to success ratio.
Absolutely. Yeah. Our
success to effort is probably better, because it was incredibly high. And we always say this about blog posts. The less effort you put in, the more successful they usually are, or the more popular they get. The things you care about, nobody else cares about it at all.
No, never goes that way. The difficult, it's not a game I can just put online. Because here's the thing, like, there's no way of putting cheat detection into a game like that. Because it's a reaction test.
It runs on the client side, doesn't it?
Well, there's a lot of games that run on the client, right? But the server can verify that, yes, those moves were valid. But with a game like this, it's saying is like, yes, you did it in 200 milliseconds. There's no way of verifying that. Like, you know, even if you're sort of sending that data over to the server, then, you know, whole like pings just destroy the data because it's so fast. It's only ever going to be something that will be run locally at events. I'll probably make like a no scoreboard version of it.
And you'll stand behind the people scrutinizing them if they're cheating.
Well, there's been a talk of like, you know, could we run the game in the F1 paddock? And I've been making it very clear that yes, this will need an engineer on site that's familiar with the code base in order to make sure that there's no cheating going on. But they haven't taken me up on that yet.
Who could that engineer be?
Well, there's only one person familiar with the code base. That's the thing.
Let's see if that works out.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll keep trying. You never know.
To finally finish off this, the Shopify interview story.
Oh, yes.
Systems design. I think I did okay, just not super great. Mostly because I literally missed a couple of opportunities where, like, for example, we were talking about how much we could cache certain API responses, and I just missed a very obvious answer that, because in my head, caching times are set at compile time, which is wrong. Like, if you write a server, you can calculate them on every request. But because we have been like thinking about static builds and deploying to Netlify as a static site so long, for so many years, I was just like automatically thinking, I need to set caching headers at compile time.
Or set and on the server, invalidation can be dynamic, right?
Exactly.
It can know when to flush the cache.
Yeah, it was like, okay, we know that like new data comes in on the hour, every hour. What do you say for the caching header? And the obvious answer is, well, you see how much time is left in the hour, and that's your caching header. And I just didn't see that answer until she like literally pushed my head into it, because I was absolutely stuck in static site thinking. That was a really, really interesting just to see like how much I had.
I will still say that if you're pushing data on the hour every hour, like setting a cache header that is like, I don't know, an hour minus a bit of safety, that still seems incredibly risky to me. Like the amount of, you know, it seems like a decision you'd make in advance and then regret it later because, we've now got a bit of data that is saying something accidentally rude or something that is dangerously factually incorrect. And, but I, you know,
I mean, this was for API responses.
Right. So I think on the server, the answer is you would manually invalidate. I mean, because this is an API response is going out. Hold on. Where is this caching happening? Is this caching happening on the server or is it caching on the client?
I mean, in this case, it was an HTTP caching header. What value?
Oh, I see. Right. But that still leaves you with the thing of like some clients have dangerously outdated data. Like, you know, you thought, it's going to be 40 minutes until we're updating this data. But you know, then something happens, like, I don't know, a president dies or something, the queen dies or whatever, right? One of these things where all of a sudden, like, you know, or all of a sudden, like, data that seemed innocuous now seems really insensitive. And then you've got clients that are now waiting 45 minutes in order for it to no longer be offensive or something. You know what I mean? Like, I always...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably a valid concern to bring up. like this, like that is always an issue with these caching headers, I think the answer would have probably been, let's not worry about this in this specific use case or something like that.
I think like a more valid thing, like if the API call is expensive, then caching on the server seems like a better solution, or even caching on the edge, because in a emergency situation, you know, you have the calls to go and flush those caches.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, you can always also deploy a new front-end version where you add cache busting to the API call.
Yeah. Well, it depends who's in charge of that, right? Who's in charge of those? If it's like third parties, I guess it's harder. Yeah.
Now, in this case, it was like we are building a front-end and we need to also specify the API contract.
Fair enough then. So you can have a an emergency, like a key that goes along with all of the requests, and in an emergency change that key.
I think even in this use case, something being offensive was fairly unlikely. Anyway, so that was the systems design, and it was just an interesting thing for me to realize that I hadn't built like full stack stuff in a while, and it's something I'm doing a bit more often. It's nice to get back to it. Like a lot of things have changed, and I'm definitely rusty. Yeah, and then the last interview was what they called a deep dive, where they basically wanted me to select a project of mine that I have worked on and know a lot about and just explain it, show it off to an interviewer, and they would ask questions about it and wanted to hear what I did. And I basically just talk an hour about Squoosh and the interesting things that we had to solve and that we encountered from switching from React and from Webpack with Preact to Rollup and Preact to WebAssembly to our mobile story, our caching. It's you know what? We built a good project there. Like, it has a lot of very interesting facets. No, but it's genuinely nice to see that it's actually still popular, even though I think it's about time to give it some love again, and neither of us really currently have a lot of time to spare.
Well, because the people working on it were kind of actively recently. It was me, you, Jason, and Ingvar. And now at Google, there is only me left.
That's true.
I got other stuff to do.
Well, I genuinely want to still work on it. I still have access to the repository. I asked if I can remain on the repository. But now it's just a question of time and coordination and motivation, I suppose. But it's one of the projects I'm very proud of.
Oh, yeah. And it is on my backlog is to go and talk again to the AVIF folks and the JXL folks and say, like, right, what's your deal? Like, what have... Because we haven't updated those codecs in a while, but updating the codecs is one thing.
Yeah.
But it's more about, like, okay, what settings have you been looking at recently? What's new there? What can we give developers to tweak these things? Because that's the bits I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
So it's always more than just updating the Git hash of the code
dependency. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, Jenny. Exactly. I'm genuinely also interested. I wanted to check how AVIF is doing on the web. If there's been significant pickup, I basically switched over to it on my blog, still with a fallback. But I think once Safari ships it, I can even remove the fallback. And I think JXL still hasn't made it into stable, or has it?
No, it's not in any browser yet. It's like the studies they put out, they make big claims about the quality. It's not something I've felt myself, but their studies are scientific, mine are not. But then also, every test they do is based on 1x screens, and I just feel like most people on the web are not looking at a 1x screen.
Yeah. Well, that was always for me, where I feel like JPEG XL was, was designed for the web, but not exclusively. So I feel like that's always their argument. It's like, well, we also just want to like recompress existing images and maintain the quality. And it's like, okay, fair enough. But the two of us always come at it specifically from the web angle.
I think that there's an open goal there for a codec to make full use of high density. Because I do think that the way you would compress the images is different. And we already know that you can go for lower quality and get what I'm pretty certain is like same perceptual quality. Because all of the you know, all of the garbage, all of the artifacts are smaller. They're harder to see, you know? But yeah. I do think, like, is it just a matter of, you know, doing the same thing and it works? Or is there, you know, different settings? Is there a different
tweaks? Think it's really interesting. It's something I probably, I don't know if that's been looked into. I mean, I definitely know that most, all of the metrics, like the computational metrics to measure image difference that we have, even the one that claimed to be psychovisual, like DSM, still, you know, take the source image and the compressed image and do math on a pixel by pixel comparison, which on the web isn't necessarily true. Like the original could be, you know, 4 or 5x because it's shown on a small space, while the compressed image could have a very different resolution. How do you compare if those two are perceived the same? No metric, as far as I know, factors that in.
Yeah, agreed. And it's, but I think some of the studies that the GXL folks have done have shown, like, yes, some of these metrics that are supposed to be somewhat close to human perception are not. Whereas I think there's some of the newer ones, like, you know, the Buttigali, is that how it's pronounced?
Buttigali.
Buttigali. Okay, I think that does much better.
Yeah, that is one of the, I think, one of the best psychovisual metrics we have. It's also quite slow to calculate, which is, I think, why it hasn't seen a lot of adoption. But again, I don't think it factors in density or display size or anything like that, because, you know, the artifacts can be quite big in a way, but if it's displayed in a very small scale, it doesn't really matter. Like, I know this is all super hand wavy, but I basically agree with you that screen size and screen density are factors for what kind of compression artifacts are acceptable, and they should probably be passed in, like, the whole, like, this is the I want to compress this image for a 2x display ratio, pixel density ratio, should be parameters for the compressor, because it allows different optimizations.
So how would you design a image compression test that was relying on human perception?
I mean, in the end, after reading a bit more about color spaces and similar things, there's so many factors that are hard to standardize, and that, for example, even your environmental lighting affects how you perceive an image, right? Like, it matters whether you look at it on a screen in a dark room or in a lit up room, whether it's sunlight or warm room light or whatever, like, all these things affect your color perception. In the end, I guess you would have to just have a study with a huge amount of participants, and you record the things that you can control for.
What device are they on?
Yeah.
Stop them from zooming in.
Will we at some point, for example, get a media query that allows us to detect whether night shift is on, or like what color temperature is the screen autocorrect? Obviously, with a huge effect of how the image is perceived. Is that something that needs to be part of a media query and a codec parameter? I'm not sure, but that's what I mean.
There's even a fundamental difficulty in, you know, if you show the user two images and you ask them which is best, it leaves the door kind of weirdly open for a compressor that is
enhancing,
creating a more pleasing image, but it doesn't represent the original as another one.
Add some clarity, add some texture, edge detection, increase the edges, bit of contrast. I mean, that's what I've been noticing more and more. When you take a photo with at least with the Pixel phones, and you immediately open it up, it is still processing. And if you look at what happens once it goes from the preview to processing, the phone does a lot. Like, they actually, they do all kinds of smoothing and contrast enhancing. It's really, really interesting. And yeah, I guess that's what you mean. Like, if a codec would apply those kind of things, that could skew it.
Even just, like, you know, give someone smoother skin so they look younger, right? Like is that, you know, is that betterer? Is that, you know? And I think what I've seen some of the recent codec comparisons do is they give you a keyboard shortcut or a button that lets you toggle to the original.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that presents its own problems, because I think that highlights the artifacts in a way that the human eye would not have otherwise detected.
That, yeah, that's a very tricky thing, because I feel like what you aim for with image compression on the web, at least, you want to create an image that looks right. It doesn't need to be indistinguishable from the original. It just needs to look right. And
but it can't misrepresent the original in a way that would, like, if, you know, if it's a product image, now misrepresents the product, you know, like it's, you know, it's not got some of the, you know, it's turned a rough edge into a smooth edge. Whereas, like, you know, when the thing arrives and it's got a rough edge, you're like, that's not the picture on the
right.
website.
But you know, if one edge is slightly less sharp in the background, which is not essential, or
exactly.
a certain gray is slightly desaturated, that will stand out if you do this flicking back and forth or you have them side by side. But in the end, is it a valid and good compression? Like, if those changes allow you to, you know, reduce the image by 10%, that's unlikely, but let's assume that will be the case.
Yeah, that's why I think it's still right that you would be picking between two compressed images and you'd be picking which one is best. But yes, I think there would need to be a button that would show you the original. But I think the key there is that it doesn't show you the original in the same X and Y position as either of the compressed versions. Like, you can imagine a split view where, you know, on the left-hand side you've got one compressed version, on the right-hand side you've got the other compressed version. But when you do the toggle to the original, it's showing you the original in the middle. So there, because it's got that horizontal shift, it no longer allows you to, it no longer gives you that superhuman perception of what has actually changed. And I think that would work, because you would be able to see, like, oh, hang on, this product has changed. And your human eyes would notice that, because you have, as a human, decided that that's the focal point of the image. Whereas, yeah, if it was something in the background that wasn't quite as sharp, your human brain would be like, well, I'm not looking at that so hard. It's not the focus of the image. So if that is a little bit different, who cares? You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that's...
I wonder how many people we've lost over the last couple minutes by nerding out on the details of image compression.
Oh, well, Cassie Evans, for one.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
This would be a massive, massive waste of her time.
Because I'm, for the first time, I'm recording this in a GarageBand. I only know that we've been recording for 1,550 bars.
Excellent.
I have no idea what time we're at.
Oh, one thing I wanted to talk about is, like I say, I've been recording two or three with other people. And it's been weird going from a situation where we did it for years, you know? Like, it was all kind of...
a well-oiled machine.
Well, yeah, certainly there was lots that was just second nature, or that we did without thinking about it, that when you bring someone new into the studio, you have to make sure they know about these things that you've just forgotten are even weird. And one of those things happened with Ada on the recordings I did with her. Remember, like, talk me through how an episode of 2 or 3 ends in the studio.
Well, I feel like... you know, you get a sense for when there is no more slides, and you kind of have the ominous, and that's how you do keyboard events, or like, this is what I learned recently about Dino, or whatever. Like, there's like the subtle phrase about this is the end, mate, and then we just stare at each other awkwardly for about a minute and just hold it because we need, you know, a bit of tape for the fade out and the credits.
Well, exactly, and it's weird, isn't it? Because it's not a minute. It feels like a minute. It's about 5 seconds, I would say. As you say, and that's how we do keyboard events, and we just kind of stare at each other, and then
longingly,
someone will go cut, and then we're done,
and then we all just relax into our chairs and recover from the awkward eye locking that we had to endure.
Exactly. I didn't tell Ada about that, so just totally forgot. So what would happen is, I would do, like, you know, as you said, and say something like, and by doing that we can make the web faster, and Ada went yes, and then I'd stare at Ada, which in normal human interactions
means is, say something,
say more, fill this empty space, because it's all, like, that's what you do with awkward silences. So that's what would happen. Like, Ada would for a couple of seconds, and then go, Another thing, mate, we recorded an episode for about 40 minutes.
Well, the thing is that Ada is also, you know, a developer advocate and quite good at talking and probably threading that
stuff.
Needle.
Absolutely. A hell of an edit job on one of the episodes, just because we covered so much, and the content was good, you know. But I didn't think people were going to sit through 40 minutes of it. So I think we edited it down to like 20, but it was absolutely brutal. And and that was in my notes now, right at the top. Is it remind people about the awkward end? Yeah.
And did it work with Cassie then?
Yes. Oh, first thing I said. By the way,
this is going to be awkward.
There's going to be a bit where I say, and now we know about SVG paths. Nod.
Should we give people inside scoop about the original first episode with someone else than me?
Yeah.
Because I remember that you were, you know, we were chatting at some point. You were like, oh, I'm going to try and, you know, do now like rotating guests on 2 or 3 and going to start with Ada. And I was like, oh, that's a really cool idea. Looking forward to it, blah, blah, blah. And then at some point you sent me a DM saying, would you be okay if there was a weird Surma puppet that we are worshipping? And I was like,
yes.
Yeah?
The mannequin. And I was upset that I had to send that message to you. That was our production team made me send that because I thought it would have been so much funnier that if you were seeing for people who haven't seen it, at the start of the first episode I did with Ada, we did a little, I thought it would be funny to do a little sketch as if like I had created a mannequin of Surma in order to, you know,
grieve my loss.
To help me get over you or to, you know, so I could sit in the studio with you once again. And Ada walks in, sees the mannequin, and I'm like, oh, nothing to do with me. And, you know, so I pitched this idea. They went for it.
You did film it.
We did film it. And it took all morning. It made me realize, like, you know, because we film episodes of 2 or 3 just as it's, like, it's one take and done. And then we edit it. Whereas it turns out, if you're doing a scripted thing with walking and talking and props, that takes all morning to do what was like a 1 minute sketch. Like, it was an absolute nightmare in that. But yes, they said it, like, are you sure Surma's going to be fine with this? And I said, yes. And they said, have you checked? And I said, no, but wouldn't it be funny if? And they went, no, that would not be funny. You have to go and talk to him. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I understand them, but I agree it would have been a lot better if I hadn't known about it. That would have been really good.
Oh well. We have talked a lot. It feels like we again didn't talk through half of our
We had a lot of time to collect topics to talk about, so I think we'll be set for a couple episodes. You know? Should I jinx it again? It's like maybe we'll do another one in a shorter period than half a freaking year?
Yeah, let's give that a go. I mean, it's over half a year, isn't it? That's the terrifying thing. It's been like from February until now, I've just been bouncing from deadline to deadline, which is really unusual in this role for me. Like,
but the video did on the page transitions did do well, didn't it?
Yeah. Actually, do you know what? There is a... how long is this podcast going to be? There is actually an interesting element to page transitions is that the default animation that happens
the fade.
The fade. It's not just a fade because it also
the
moves
transition
the element from
it,
its...
Yeah.
But that includes width and height.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So does that mean if I have like... You know, I have a div with a line of text in it, and I have the same div that is a lot higher, but with the same text in it, that in the transition, the text will get stretched because they're flattened to a texture, right, during the transition?
Yes. So the default we're going to do is that the two images, the before and after, are going to sit at the top of the box and match the width. So you can think of it as like if you put an image in there, in an element and make it 100% width. It sits at the top of the element, and scales of the width. That we went through a lot of the material design stuff on transitions, and that seems to be the sensible default.
Right.
But you could apply height 100% as well.
Okay.
And create a stretchy thing if you also, so wanted.
Also, basically, it has an aspect ratio by default of the original aspect
yeah.
ratio. Okay.
Yeah, height auto, width 100%. But you could give it height 100%, get it, and it'll be stretchy, but then you could apply objects, object fit and object position. And yeah, and you can customize it that way. But we're animating width and height, which puts us on, in traditional terms,
slow path.
The main thread path. I mean, there's so little layout in the layer
yeah,
that we
because
create
there's
for
yeah,
these
there's
things.
Only the pseudo elements, which is, there's like three.
Yes.
If you go nuts, there's 10.
Right. But it definitely puts us on the main thread.
Yes.
And I that would be problematic for regular MPA navigations because there's a bit of a main thread car crash. You know,
well, it's interesting because I suppose in this specific scenario, there is no layout to be done. Everything is kind of positioned absolutely.
Well, there's layout. If you're changing the width and height of one thing and the thing inside it is width 100%, it's still layout.
I guess the hierarchy still exists. I wasn't sure if they're still hierarchical, or if everything just goes to top level flat, like just a top level list of children.
We have nested pseudo elements, which is so yeah. We've got a container, and then we've got a wrapper, and inside that wrapper, we've got the before and after.
I guess
images.
The reason I thought that is because you had the example in the video where, like, well, with overflow hidden, you know, things animating from inside the container would get clipped. And now in the page transition API, that wouldn't happen anymore because they get... And I thought that was because they all get promoted to top level. I guess that...
Well, they do, but every transitioning thing is a nested structure that is the container, a wrapper, and then the before and after images.
I see.
And one feature we do want to add is the ability to nest one transitioning element within another for the cases where you do want that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's what we're going to ship initially. But yes, we still have nesting of the pseudos, but each transitioning element is top level, but each transitioning element is made up of a, you know, structure of pseudo elements. And that's fun as well, because it's not the first time that's happened. You can have a marker inside a before. So... We're not the first. Yeah, marker, like colon marker, which is like for bulleted lists. That's the marker. So yes, you can have a before with a marker, and that's the one of the only other like nested pseudo elements. So we're jumping in with like three levels of nesting and multiple children and stuff. So it's still quite a big thing. One of the things I've actually been trying to figure out today is if our selectors are doing the right thing, given that that's what our pseudo elements are doing. But the thing I won't say is, like, because we could do these transitions using pure transforms, but we decided not to because that makes them really hard to customize. Like, you know, especially if you want clipping.
Yeah.
Because you end up with like the counter transform thing happening, all of that sort of stuff. So we said, like, well, let's just animate this with width and height, because that is the simple thing to do. Developers understand it. It's easy to customize. But our next mission is, can we move it to the compositor for these specific cases? And how much can we stay on that happy path with the likely customizations that developers are going to do?
Well, one of the big advantages is that the animations are declarative.
Yes, but if someone adds a, like, if they take the content of one of those images and makes it text, which you can do, so now you've got text layout inside your transforms. Like we'll have to bail, right? There's no way we can do that on the compositor.
No, for sure. But I mean, it's declarative, so these things can be statically analyzed, and we could literally just. We could put warnings in DevTools. I say we.
Oh,
it's not
exactly.
We anymore. It's you.
No, it's me, isn't it? But yeah, that is the plan. Because yeah, if you add like a border to the transitioning elements, again, I think that's where we start to bail out, because we're not going to be able to do that entirely on the compositor.
It seems like an awful idea visually.
Yeah, well, isn't it? It depends, like, because if you've got a button that has rounded corners and it changes width, one of the things we've been thinking of is, like, you know, can we do this in a way that is your stays on the compositor but also doesn't stretch the image, you know? So there's all kinds of fun things we're thinking about for that. It might turn out that the transitions are fast enough that it doesn't matter in most cases, but again, stuff to figure out.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to test it on low-end phones. Get the banana phone back out.
Yes. I mean, one of the ideas we threw around was that we just pause everything during the transition so we don't get that car crash at the start of a page loading. But I think that the opportunity of page transitions is that you can, you know, be doing a lot of work while the page transition is happening. Because we got a lot of comments of like, oh, this is going to make pages slower. And it's like, I hope it wouldn't, because I hope that, you know, the transition happens, but in the background, it's still setting up the stuff for the first interaction.
And I wonder if the layout could happen on a different thread. Like, because there's no user JavaScript or anything in that moment, that the layout for the transition elements could be a separate thread.
Yeah, that's one of the other ideas we've had. We are shied away from that for now. Just because that would be such a major re-architecture of how the browser works.
Yeah, that would be a rejig for sure. I'm guessing it would be like similar to a worklet architecture, but yeah, I can understand if the MVP of this API doesn't do that.
And also that the CSS that is driving this stuff is on the main thread.
Yeah.
So it would kind of be shipping that stuff across, and what if it changes halfway through? It is one of our possibilities if we can't do it any other way.
You know what? We should really talk to Cassie about this.
This is animations. Why isn't Cassie here? Oh, now we've wasted her time. Like, she's sitting somewhere else. Do you know what? She's probably like talking to someone about coffee or something, which is a massive waste of her time when she could be using her time valuably right now. Oh,
what a shame.
We are such bad men.
Well, I think that is a good point to just call it before we descend into further madness.
absolutely. Well, this has been fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully get this edited and out sooner than 6 months. And I guess there's nothing else to say. God, we haven't done this for a while. Yeah. Nothing left to say except
happy next time.
Bye.